Hi, this is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. And this week I'm here with Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Chris. How are you doing?
Not bad, thanks. How about you? Sort of midway into the first month of the new year?
Yeah, I failed on my dry January, but I'll blame my boss and also my wife for that. But
well, I haven't. I'm still abstemious. I've managed to survive 14 days, which is almost a record.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, so I'm quite pleased, which is good.
Well, I was in an airport when I broke it, so airports don't count anyway.
Yeah, well, okay, I'll let you off on that one. Fair enough. This week we've got a guest, and we'll ask Nigel. Nigel, are you doing dry January?
I'm doing a dry gin January, so it's a little bit different to yours, but it's working for me.
I'm doing a dry whiskey one. I think next time, then I'll promise I won't ever drink whiskey for the whole. Does that count or not?
We could just do a dry wine.
Yeah, true. So Nigel tells it you work for Commvault. Why don't you give everybody a bit more detail on who you are and what you do?
I do. My title is Solutions Marketing Director for EMEA. My background is on the tech side of things. I'm a long-term Commvault employee I'm into my 12th year now.
Wow, amazing. So I checked actually, Nigel, and 12 months ago, almost to the day, we recorded a podcast on GDPR.
I remember it well.
Yeah, that was really interesting. We're not going to talk about that today, actually, but it's fascinating to see how that's changed in the last 12 months. Just before we move on and talk about our subject of the day, do you think that was a big storm in a teacup, or do you think people have really sort of changed their approach towards how they manage their data since GDPR came in?
They certainly are changing things. I think there's a view in the market that if you can be trusted with people's data, and when I say trust, I mean do the right thing with the data, protect the data, keep it available, those kind of things, that you're going to be in a better place. For me, I'm a little bit sad that the regulators haven't been a bit more involved in some of the stuff. I mean, there's still a lot of bad practices going on from selling data and shifting it around. So hopefully, I think they're going after the big tech companies first. Maybe once that's out of the way, we'll see a bit more action from them in 2019.
Okay, fair enough. We'll come back to that one another time. But this time round, we thought it'd be really interesting to talk about a subject that seems to have been everywhere over the last 12 months, and that's the idea of ransomware. Now, just to give you an idea before we go in and dive into that as a discussion, I actually saw something today that was talking about some city, I'm guessing was in the US, that had to flip back to using paper systems because ransomware had taken all of their computer environment down. So this is a genuine problem. It's something that we've seen in the NHS and a few other parts of the UK. So why don't we start off by at least putting a definition to it, and why don't you give us what your sort of definition of what ransomware is?
Yeah, sure. Well, in its simplest form, it's a program that infects your computer, works in the background to encrypt the data, but it continues to provide access to you until an arbitrary point, whether all the data's gone or some date or time limit. And then it shuts off the key, so you can no longer access your data. Now, in some cases, and ransomware is a bit of a tight definition. A lot of people refer to malware now because there's some programs that just want to cause mischief but have a similar operating method to ransomware. And they might just encrypt some files on your computer that stop it from booting or to delete them or modify. So it can leave you without access to your data. And let's face it, that's what most people use their computers for, whether in the data center or their own personal machines.
Now, in terms of the definition, the term ransom specifically means that people, hackers, whoever they are, we'll come back to discuss who they might be in a minute, but whoever they are out there who are getting this virus installed on your machine are actually looking to financially gain from it by holding you to ransom, to extortion, basically.
That's right. So the first indication you have of a problem is some kind of pop-up on your machine that tells you that your files are encrypted. And then they ask for some Bitcoin and normally give you some way to pay them. So they're generally using untraceable currency to do that.
And this can affect every type of machine? Within Commvault, have you seen this on desktop servers, Windows, Linux, or do you see it being targeted at a very specific area?
Unfortunately, Windows seems to be the biggest target, though, of course, it can affect Linux and Macs. You know, all those Mac users who think they don't need antivirus or to be secure, they absolutely do. So, yeah. And you know, it can affect the biggest companies or individual users. Whichever one of those you are, it can be a pretty stressful time.
So, Martin, I think when I look at this, I think Windows still has a huge issue, I guess, from the install base, but possibly from some of the older exposures that exist within SMB to allow people to get into the systems that shouldn't be.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is people don't patch regularly. there's still a lot of hardware, old hardware out there, which may or may not run the latest versions of Windows. Even if you think, I mean, for a lot of people, a lot of people's mind, even things like Windows 7 is probably still fairly recent, but that goes out in the next 12 months, I believe. So there's so many old version of Windows still floating around. And how many times have you been past a display of some sort and you'll see it's crashed and you'll see a Windows 2000 or even a Windows NT screen showing where something's crashed. So, I mean, yeah, Windows is probably one of the worst systems. There's so many of them, and so many people haven't kept them up to date.
Yeah, we'll come back and talk about, you know, strategies about how you should be patching and stuff later. But I think you're right. And it's amazing to see the number of devices. I mean, I'm trying to think where I was. I think it was, might have been in South Africa. And the till that was serving or taking credit card payments in one of the resorts or the places we're in had some ridiculously old version of Windows running on it. And I looked at it and thought, there's no way that's been patched. There's no way that's up to date. And if that in any way is on a network, that is an extremely exposed device.
There's medical devices as well. It's not uncommon to find medical devices running an embedded version of Windows. And these things are very vulnerable. And obviously medical devices, especially, you end up ransomware on one of those or your machine, one of those locked out, you've got a major problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nigel, I mean, that in itself, let's go back, let's go on and talk about how these sort of things get installed. And Martin's really picked on one area there, which is interesting, the idea of medical devices. The NHS suffered in a big way. Where is the ransomware coming from? I mean, from my perspective, I remember for the NHS exploit, we think there was a big attempt to try and infect as many machines as possible within the NHS, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. I mean, if you look to the NCSC, the UK's National Cybersecurity Agency, they think there's a lot of state involvement in this. And, you know, there is. I mean, I think there's something like, since they've been instigated just over a couple of years ago, there's 10 incidents a week that they look at. And most of those, they think, are, you know, rogue states and enemies of the UK. That said, what really makes ransomware and malware in general like this problematic is there's still a lot of cyber criminals out there that actually run almost like a service. Ransomware is a service kind of a model. You can go on the dark web, download a kit, and they actually give you some basic training about how to infect people and modify the code, the messages. And that's kind of what makes some of this stuff more difficult to spot. I think the other worrying thing, too, is when ransomware first became hit the news, it was very much something that hit individuals. And I think the cyber criminals have worked out now that they can get much more leverage if they hit a business, because obviously businesses can't operate without their data. And what we've seen is a shift now towards this combination of, you know, not blanket spam kind of attacks, but, you know, finding out some intel about the organization and the individuals that they're actually trying to hit and using spear phishing techniques to get them. And of course, when you do that, it becomes a lot easier for the users to, you know, take that bit of action that's needed to install the malware on their devices.
I think that's a really worrying trend, and I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, and you made an amazing point there, that initially this might well have been targeted at people with their own home PCs, who at the end of the day may pay up or may not pay up. You know, I personally, if I had a backup of the data, I'd just start again, and I'd just, you know, wipe the whole machine. I wouldn't pay up. And I we'll come on to a question about the financial side of it in a minute. But if you're a large organization, you might actually be physically losing money, and somebody high up might say, do you know what, it's worth paying rather than trying to fix the problem, I guess.
Yeah, again, if you talk to organizations like the security services in the US, UK, and most of the West, they'll tell you not to pay up. In some cases, you can actually find that, you know, the low end of the attacks, you can actually go find the keys online. There are companies that can help you out, even search engines that'll help you to do that, depending on the kind of message that you've got. So there are ways around it. And you do hear the odd story about companies paying out. But of course, it's not in their interest to publicise that fact. So you know, you don't really know how much of it does go on where people just pay up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story going around at the moment. I seen one today about the Ryuk ransomware. It's made $3.7 million in Bitcoin over the past 5 months. So, yeah, there's money to be made out of this from the criminal gangs.
It's an interesting point you just raised there, Nigel. Sorry, I just want to go back to that for a second because I don't want to lose that. And that's the fact that when somebody's installing ransomware on your machine, potentially, if they are using a kit or they're using some sort of software, they could also be using a shared encryption key. And therefore, if you know what type of ransomware is being installed, theoretically, the key might be out there for you to unlock your machine if you could find it. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, no, there are people that will help you find the keys. There are websites and things where you can look. But of course, there's no guarantee that it's going to be successful. And some of the people who use these kits are a bit smarter about things than others. So they might well change the key or use a different password or whatever. So there's no guarantee. It's certainly... You can't be laissez-faire about it and just think, oh, I'll be able to find the key somewhere, because that's just not the case.
No, and I think if you think about somebody who's trying to infect tens or thousands of machines, or even hundreds of thousands of machines, how do they even know what key they infected your machine with?
Yeah, that's true.
Unless it was the way for them to keep track of it. So in terms of whether somebody actually will bother to unlock your machine if you paid up, it makes me wonder whether they ever would even if you did pay.
Well, at the end of the day, Chris, they are criminals, and you don't know who they are, where they are, so you've got no comeback whatsoever. So, yeah, you just can't think that you're going to, unencrypt things yourself.
So, financially then, I mean, Martin, we briefly talked about, financial impact of being down in terms of your own PC. You'd probably just format and start again. But, for a large organization, and you've worked in many large organizations, as have I, how on earth would you go about sort of quantifying what you think the impact would be of something like this?
How would you go around quantifying this? I would suggest that most businesses don't really know how much a massive outage is going to cost them. But you've got business down, you've got reputational damage, if your business is down for any length of time. So the quantification is very high to carry out, but it will be large generally. You'll end up all over headlines. And then there is such bad reputational damage. If when it leaks out, you'll end up on the register, you'll end up on the front page of the papers, that your business was down, and probably because you didn't keep adequate security methods.
Yeah, I mean, Nigel, what about US companies? Do you have deal with many where they look at the impact of this? Because I would have thought in the US, there's more likely to be litigation from their clients if something happens to a company.
Well, I mean, just put this in perspective, even before you get down to the fears of litigation, I mean, outages can literally cost tens of thousands of dollars per hour, depending on the size of your business. But in the middle of last year, there's a great example from the city of Atlanta in the US. They were hit by SamSam. And they only, and I say only, had a $52K ransom to find. But of course, the FBI wouldn't let them pay the ransom. And straight away, they ended up paying out something like $2.6 million in third-party contracts to keep the city government running and all of the other things that hang off that. And that doesn't include the downtime and extra staff hours and all of the other expenses. That's just the third-party contracts.
I guess there's no guarantee that even if they paid that money, that would have fixed the problem, though, I guess.
No, that's right. And even if in a perfect world, you paid the ransom, they gave you the key, you've still got to wipe everything off, reinstall it, patch everything, go back and fix any vulnerability so, they don't come back to you again. So it's really hard. I mean, actually, there's one story I read earlier last year, and it was a UK council that got hit. And the ICO actually fined them something like $50K for being careless. So it's not just the pain of getting hit by ransomware. You've also got the insult on top of injury of that happening.
Yeah, I suppose people may not think about it in those terms, but clearly, if you get something that gets into your network behind the firewall, could be on servers as well as PCs. If you are trying to get rid of it, you're first of all going to have to identify it's there. But even if you do, and even if you did get a key to unlock it, you're going to want to reformat and restart all those machines and make sure there's absolutely nothing else that could infect you later. Because there's nothing to say that just because you had a problem that you fixed this time, that virus or that malware couldn't come back again and do exactly the same thing in another month's time.
No, that's right. And you know what? I mean, one of the first things that they say is if you suspect a machine to be infected, of course, remove it from the network and isolate it. But if you think about it, I mean, we've had some customers that have been hit and they actually can't recover to their own data center because they're bringing back virtual machines and servers and other things that carry the vulnerability already. And if you put them back in that environment, there's a chance that they can get hit again. And it's one of the things that can really hurt you during the recovery process is not having somewhere to recover that's away from the old production system that was so severely compromised.
And I guess, Martin, it also says that depending on your backup schedule, as Nigel's just highlighted, if this has been sitting there for months, all of your backups could be compromised anyway if you're not keeping backups for a long time.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's a nightmare scenario for a lot of companies to have a ransomware attack in your data center. Forget about your individual PCs, but within your data center. It's, you don't know when it hit. You don't know what's impacted. You don't know if you've been impacted in other ways, because if you've got ransomware into your data, ended up in your data center, you've probably got other security issues as well. So you don't know whether you've got data loss or data leakage going on. So I can just imagine the panic in the C-suite as they realize that potentially their company's in real trouble at this point.
You raise a good point there, Martin, about the backups not going back long enough. And what we've seen as well, I'm glad to say no Commvault customers ever lost their backups due to this, but the move away from tape, which is a nicely air-gapped, you know, recovery system that once it's on there, it's away from the network, it's effectively shut off to external changes. That's a really good way of protecting yourself from ransomware. So many companies now have gone down the route of backing up to disk because it's got so many other advantages that tape doesn't, that, you know, if those systems aren't protected, then the backups themselves can get encrypted by the same thing that's hitting your primary systems, and then you're in real trouble.
I was just thinking back to something that I did in about 1989. I came up with an idea, and I'm not sure. I'm not saying I invented ransomware, so don't take it the wrong way. I'm not meaning that. But I remember looking. I'm going to go back to it. It's my weekly mainframe story. I always like to try and find some excuse to get a mainframe story in here. So when 89, when I was working in one particular location, it dawned on me that when you wrote and read through an IO request, you could actually run an exit that would allow you to change the data. And it was meant to be an exit that allowed you to encrypt the data to disk for obviously very sensible and safe reasons. But it struck me that you could actually do that and put that encryption in and leave it in and let it run for literally months and corrupt all the backups and have them all encrypted too. And then the day you leave or you want to hold them to ransom, you just delete that exit and say, yeah, don't use it anymore. And then all of that data is now encrypted. Now, obviously, I didn't even try to write something like that, and I would never do it because that is absolutely going to get you locked up. But, you know, you can see that there are both deliberate exposures in systems and obviously other exposures in systems that allow this to happen that you really have to be very careful about.
Actually, Chris, you raise a really good point there because, you know, and I've called out the security services a couple of times, who you think are there to protect us. But unfortunately, they will actually leave exploits they've discovered so that they can exploit them against foreign actors before they actually warn the company, whether it's Microsoft or Apple or, you know, somebody else, which is kind of scary. And they actually take that balanced risk as to whether it's a risk to the wider public and business above whether they can actually use it for, not nefarious means, because I suppose in our case that they're looking
at to their advantage, I guess.
To their advantage.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think we pretty much convinced ourselves that ransomware, getting to the point of the ransomware being there, is the worst thing possible. The question is, what can we do? What can businesses do to protect themselves from this happening in the first place? Where's the first place to start?
Well, you know what? Defense in depth is the first thing that you've got to do. You can't ignore. I mean, traditional sort of antivirus software got caught on the hop a little bit by this. They're starting to catch up now, but that's not perfect. The fact that people, you know, these organizations are using spear phishing to trick people into doing things, so there's an element of social engineering, also makes it very difficult to guard against. So you've got to do all those good things, that, you know, ensuring things like your firewalls and everything are up to date. You need to make sure, you know, your systems are patched. That's going to fit your change control, of course, because as we all know, updates can break things just like they can give you new defenses. And then, of course, you've got to really think about backup, how you're going to recover things, and indeed, you know, trying out and understanding your disaster recovery plans, because if they're not working properly when you don't test them, you can be in real trouble. I mean, one of our customers lost something like 10,000 servers literally overnight to NotPetya. And when they came to start their recovery, as I mentioned, they couldn't actually recover in their own data center, so they had to get gear to bring it all back to. And then, you know, you've got no DNS, you've got no Active Directory. All of the things that would normally support your recovery systems have gone away. Your email doesn't work, communications, networks are down. And it really can be, completely horrific. I mean, imagine losing 10,000 servers overnight. It's really scary.
Apart from that, it sounds like it's all fine.
Yeah.
that would be utterly awful. I'm trying to think if I've ever been in a situation where I've ever had to do a mass recovery. Have you ever had to do that, Martin?
No, I've never had to do that, thank God. I mean, I really wouldn't fancy it. I've obviously done individual machines, things like that, but I've never had anything mentioned. Actually, no, it's not quite true. We did end up doing a mass recovery, but not due to a virus or a ransomware, just due to a misconfigured script, which didn't change directories properly and then deleted everything in a directory which shouldn't have been in. So I've seen that happen, and now you just recover that. Fortunately, all those systems were protected with snaps, and it was just a case of reversing the snaps. But if we hadn't had decent backups, that would have been an absolute nightmare.
Okay. I mean, great to have the backups, but what happens if you, like we said earlier, if you don't know that you've been infected? How do you identify the point where you might have been infected? Because it seems to me that it's great to have your backup strategy all in place and know how to recover and be able to do that effectively. But if you can't identify when the ransomware has landed on your machine in a quick enough time, in a timely fashion, then you're really up against it still. It doesn't really help if you've got a great backup strategy.
Yeah, actually, Chris, that's another good point. I mean, what we've done at Commvault over the last couple of years is built in things like anomaly detection. So we monitor all, you know, people's regular use on both servers and their machines, and we can see a change in that. So if there's a lot of files get changed, we'll kind of flag that up. We also alter the retention schedules at that point so that things aren't wiped off or expired, just in case, until somebody's cleared all of that. And we also put things like honeypots around the place, so these are shares that actually look attractive for the ransomware to encrypt, so we can keep an eye on those kind of things. And when you combine that with regular threat detection systems and other monitoring tools, it does start to get easier. If not, nothing's perfect, but it does start to get easier to spot some of these kind of attacks happening, so that you can take remedial action before it becomes disastrous.
Surely you could do something along the lines of, if you're running incrementals, if you suddenly see a backup which is anomalous, it's so large, you can say, okay, something's going on there. Is this a database update? Is there something going on there? Or all these files are being changed, and that seems to be very unlikely. So I'm sure there's some intelligence you could put into the appliances.
There are. I think what's changing, though, now is that it's not just us that have built AI into our products. There's also, obviously, the security vendors have done similar things. And there's they're kind of changing. They're slowing up how quickly the encryption works. And, of course, with things like NotPetya, where it really was just encrypting one of the system files or a couple of them to stop them from booting, unless you patch that kind of stuff out, then it's really difficult to spot that on its own. So, you can put all the protections in place and still be caught out, unfortunately.
I guess some of this must be, we've got to give the obligatory machine learning AI type call out here. I'm guessing some of this must be machine learning AI type suitable for detection, rather than just relying on the fact that you've got a very big backup for once.
Oh, no, yeah. Like I said, we use the machine learning stuff to learn what ordinary user patterns are like for opening and closing files and changing them. So it doesn't just look for one big dump of large files that have been changed. It'll actually look at the pattern to see if it's changed over a period of time before it flags it up.
Okay, and what about the network, guys? I can't personally talk about the network side of things, so I don't do networking. But I'm sure that there must be some sort of joined-up process that would make sense to do, where the networking guys are trying to stop stuff coming in. But they must be able to see some of that in the traffic that's going across the network in some respect too, in order to work out that something's going on, especially if lots of machines are suddenly becoming very active.
That, again, it's not an area that's a specialist to me either, but that's where your threat detection systems can also help to spot those things. And this is why I said before, this thing notion of defense in depth. There isn't one, magic wand that's going to sort you, stop you getting affected, stop you from being affected by ransomware or malware in general. You just got to rely on lots and lots of fences and protections.
Okay, well, add one more to this then. What about patching? Now, I've got, I probably like a lot of the people, I've got an opinion on how we do patching, and it never always seems to align with everybody else. So I always think that, and that this goes back to maybe, sorry to mention it again, this goes back to my mainframe days, but we would never apply patches or do updates just because they existed. We would always look at every single patch and apply it if it has some merit to our environment. And then at some point we would do a roll up, maybe it's 3 months or 6 months, and we catch up to date on everything, but know how to back out if that was the case. Now, nowadays, I've looked into this a bit, and I think some of the security patches are definitely identified as security, but I'm not sure they go into enough depth on, say, the Windows platform, or even consistently across all platforms, to say that these are the security patches you should apply across all your environments, and they're so critical they should be applied now, versus here's some reasonably secure security related ones that need to be done in the next week. Do we think there's enough information out there in terms of how to be really, really clever and efficient with your patching?
I don't think so. But then again, if you look at some of the patch bundles which come out, say the monthly ones from Microsoft, and you've got environments where you've got 30,000 VMs and more, trying to work out what's going to impact what, and then trying to decouple the security from the quality of life patches is very, very hard. So I think you're finding that more and more people just patch, certainly within the Windows environment. I'd say the Windows guys are probably ahead of the Unix guys, and certainly massively ahead of the Mac guys about what they patch. They just patch. They just, and you'll fix those machines which fall over, which don't work properly the next day, and make sure you've got some way of reverting back. But you just patch by default and then fix on fail.
Yeah, I concur with Martin. To be honest, you see a patch nowadays and it will tell you the features if it's a feature related patch, and then you've invariably got somewhere at the bottom and various security patches. Please see this note. And then, of course, you've got to go into that and then read and find out whether it's what the risk potential for your organisation is. But, you know, as an individual user, if you're savvy with your computer, that's fine. If you're a business with thousands of VMs and various things, then that starts to get a whole lot more difficult to do. And then, of course, you've got, you know, application patching on top of that, which can be for, you know, programs like, well, whatever applications you're using and the underlying database and so on. And then there's client patching. It can become a complete nightmare.
But clearly, the way that we work it today isn't good enough, because at the very beginning of our conversation, Martin pointed out things like in the airports, you get billboards and various other things that are clearly being hacked and are displaying an incorrect message. Now, in one respect, a billboard, especially for something like advertising, is not the end of the world. You know, somebody might be upset their advert isn't there. But ultimately, that machine could still be a proxy for passing that virus on to somebody else. So just because it itself doesn't need patching, or it doesn't matter if it isn't patched properly, it's still within an environment where it could cause problems for other machines. So I still don't think that there's enough understanding, especially in that sort of wider part of IT, where the technology is used in lots of places, other than, say, in the core data center or on somebody's desk. I don't think there's quite enough of an understanding about the impact of it.
No, I agree. Though from my own experience and what I've read, most of the ransomware in particular will target a certain type of OS. So it has been a little bit different to the kind of hacking or data breach type hacks, where they're leveraging an unpatched system to get somewhere else that's got share to it or something like that. With malware in particular, it tends to look for the affected operating system. So it is a slightly different thing, I think.
Okay.
I was going to say, if you look at the risk in the States at the moment with a government shutdown, so a government shutdown means that at the moment over 80 SSL certificates have expired. I would suggest probably that systems aren't being patched. So that's a massive security risk for a system which is which is going to be key to a running of a country. So this sort of thing and ransomware, this would be the ideal time to start targeting US government departments. And if you're not protected, you could have major problems very quickly.
You've got to think that people must be attacking that exposure now, based on what you said. I agree. I read the same sort of thing about the certificates issue, and I can't believe that they're not getting absolutely hammered with people trying to do all sorts of naughty things to those servers while they're in a compromised state.
Yeah, I agree.
But there's a great example of it, isn't it, that there is still a cost in IT to doing IT that you can't step away from, and that cost profile changes, even though you might save somewhere else. You still can't really afford to not do maintenance. And that really is part of the TCO of running any sort of system these days.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's quite a large cost of maintenance. I mean, and it's all about ensuring that applications continue to work after a patch. Patching's relatively easy, Chris, but it's the application certification afterwards which generally slows everybody down.
Okay. So let's just summarise then, since we're close to the end of our time. Building a strategy, Nigel, we sort of touched on some of the bits there. You said defence and depth. What would you, if you're going into a customer, what would you recommend if they were trying to sit down and come up with a policy that they could then say they've written and you know, show to higher management?
Well, first of all, you know, you've got to work out your own risk profile. Now, again, getting third-party help in for that can be really useful. Unfortunately, we have this situation where we are underserved with security professionals these days. So you know, that risk profile is all important. Clearly then, I mean, from a security perspective, there's the defense in depth that I mentioned, but from a, you know, backup recovery DR perspective, which is obviously my own home turf, you know, you really got to make sure you've got an air gap between your systems that do the backups and the backups themselves. You know, make sure they're all protected. If you've still got tape, then that, you know, use it by all means. But if you haven't, then you do need to think about that. Some kind of offline copy creation. Use whatever things you have at your means to spot an attack. So again, any Commvault customer that's on maintenance can just switch on the protections that I mentioned before. So that's really useful. And that's an add-on to security, obviously not a replacement. And then, as I said before, you know, using whatever technologies that you have at your disposal to look at things like disaster recovery planning. Basic steps like not putting your DR plans in a digital place where they could become encrypted so you can't access them after an attack. And the other thing that we've recently put into the product over the last year is, again, another approach with AI where you can allow the system to predict whether you're going to meet your own SLAs. So you kind of tell it what your SLAs look like for the systems. And it uses machine learning that we've picked up from our customers around the globe to predict whether you're going to meet them. And if you don't, then it'll, you know, there's an autopilot or self-driving function that will rejig things, the collection systems and so on, to help you ensure you're going to meet your targets for recovery. Now, of course, it might be that you've got some infrastructure bottlenecks that no matter how much clever backup technology you've got, it's not going to get around because it's a physical problem. And again, it'll warn you about that. But, you know, the bottom line is make sure you've got your DR plans where you can access them and absolutely test them out on a regular basis. And automate that if you can, because if you don't, you can really get caught out. And again, learn from some of the experience that we've had supporting our customers that have had these challenges. Start switching off, think the unthinkable, turn off the DNS and your Active Directory and those kind of things and see if you can still do your recovery. And if you can't, then obviously work around that.
Yeah, scenario planning. Okay, Nigel, well, that was fantastic. Some really good advice there. And I think ultimately what we're saying is always have a plan. Don't just sit here and think you won't be attacked or it won't happen to you. Make sure you've got a plan in place. Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. Great conversation. And everybody who's listening to us online, thanks very much for joining us. As usual, you can find us at Storage Impact on Twitter, at storageimpact.com on the web, and at the Storage Impact LinkedIn group, where we do have some conversation, but at least you can find all of our podcasts there. And if you really want to, we'd be really happy if you gave us a nice 5-star rating on iTunes. Always helps. Once again, guys, thanks for joining and catch up soon.